Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From across the world, the news has just kept coming. From Istanbul, Baghdad, Bangladesh, Saudi Arabia, and more, news of terror attacks linked to ISIS, of hundreds killed just in the last few days. Is this ISIS stymied at home and hitting out around the world? And what's the strategy that could stop it? This hour on Point, ISIS turns up the terror far and wide. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's the answer to the latest toll of ISIS? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's the sound of the aftermath of the attack outside the Prophet's Mosque in Medina, Saudi Arabia, on Monday. Sirens, then a car in the parking lot with a bomb, suicide bombing occurred, blowing up from the heat of the fire there. You don't want that in your backyard. On Sunday morning, when Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi visited the scene of the bombing there in Baghdad that killed more than 200 people, people threw rocks and shoes at his convoy, expressing their fury over the lack of security in the country, in Baghdad. And here's Ali Mohammed, lives in the district of Baghdad, where at least something like 222 people were killed in an attack on Sunday claimed by ISIS, told the New York Times on Monday it was doubly wrong to attack as people were preparing to celebrate Eid, the end of Ramadan. Is every Eid we celebrate, is this our Eid? Is this the Eid that everybody celebrates? People came to buy clothes to celebrate Eid. Now, he says, they're buying coffins. Coffins. Joining me now from Skype in Beirut, Lebanon, is Liz Sly, Beirut Bureau Chief for The Washington Post, where she covers the Middle East and ISIS. Liz, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
Liz, the first interpretation that we're getting, including from the American military, is that ISIS is suffering losses, steady losses on the ground in what it has carved out as its caliphate, and that it's turning to terror in the region and around the world to try and reassert itself. Does that ring true from your vantage there in Beirut?
Well, it sort of does. It is true that they're losing territory. They are losing a lot of territory. The war has been going better, I think, than commanders had expected for the past few months. They probably lost about half of the territory they originally had, perhaps a bit more. So, yes, they've been suffering some major setbacks on the battlefield. At the same time, however, I think that the military commanders do say that because they like to turn the narrative back to their successes and not to the failure of controlling the spread of this group that these attacks point to. I believe this group would have done these attacks anyway. They announced that they were the Islamic State 2 years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago. They said then that they would strike out at the West. They urged their followers to strike out at the West. It took them some time before those that command, that threat was actually fulfilled. But I think even if they still had their territory, they would be doing these attacks because it's what they do. They want to blow things up. They want to create chaos and havoc.
Liz, there in Beirut, what is the meaning of these attacks in Saudi Arabia in the last couple of days? Three in Medina, holy city, of course, in Jeddah, in another town called Qatif, in the Shiite eastern Saudi Arabia. What's the significance?
Well, one significance is that, first of all, none of these attacks, only one of the attacks caused casualties. None of them caused the mass casualties among civilians that we saw in Istanbul and Dhaka. Two of the bombers just blew themselves up. One of them detonated himself among some security guards at the mosque, at the Mosque of the Prophet, and killed four of them. So they didn't have a huge impact like the other attacks did in terms of casualties. But it is interesting they are, which tells you basically that the Saudis did manage to jump on these guys or solve the problem. There were various they were able to challenge the bombers before it actually happened. But it also tells you that Saudi Arabia itself is going to suffer the threat of this Islamic State. They have carried out attacks in the past against Shiites. These attacks very deliberately targeted their three main There are three main enemies, if you like, in Saudi Arabia: the Shia Muslims, who are regarded as heretics by the Islamic State, which is a mostly Sunni group. It targeted the Americans, the American consulate in Jeddah, and it targeted the Saudi security forces. The mosque itself was not a target. The bomber blew himself up amongst security guards outside, quite a way outside, I think, during their evening meal, and it was they who got killed.
Liz, let me ask you finally, there in Beirut, where you're based for your reporting, do people think that the caliphate is a passing thing, that it rose quickly, it took over a lot of territory, now they lost Fallujah, that it will fade away? Or are people seeing it as something that's here for a while?
Well, I think in Lebanon and in the wider Middle East, people find it very hard to believe that the Islamic State will maintain this territorial control, given American airstrikes, given the determination to get rid of it. I don't think they see it as an enduring feature of the landscape at all. But I don't think anybody thinks that the Islamic State is going to go away as a terror organization, just as its ability to maintain its territorial control is slipping in the face of the military effort against it. So its capacity to carry out attacks around the world as a guerrilla force, as a terrorist organization, is increasing. So I think we're going to see a morphing of the identity of the Islamic State.
Liz Sly, Beirut Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Liz, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Let's go right around the world now to Rohan Gunaratna. He is in Singapore, head of the International Center for Political Violence and Terrorism Research at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. Rohan Gunaratna, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Could you talk for just a moment about the terror attacks from ISIS, claimed anyway, that were not quite in your backyard, but much closer to you in Bangladesh? A fairly high death toll there, 22 killed in total. Did that come out of the blue, Rohan, or did we see a ramp up to that?
The Islamic State has been building a presence in the Middle East, in Africa, in the Caucasus, and also in Asia. What they have done is they have co-opted existing threat groups and they have transformed them as proxies of the Islamic State. So on behalf of IS, these groups have conducted attacks. These groups no longer are driven by the Al-Qaeda ideology, but by the ideology of IS and the methodology of IS. They are using the same brutalism and the barbarism of IS. They are also exploiting the social media the same way IS does. And they are not only sending fighters, recruits from their countries to the IS heartland, but those who are returning from the IS heartland, they are coming to their homelands or the target countries, and they are influencing others to conduct IS-style attacks. So there's a very significant global expansion of IS at the time when IS is under severe threat in Iraq and Syria.
In Dhaka, in Bangladesh, they came into a cafe in a well-heeled part of town, took a lot of time, kind of overnight hostage holding there, and very methodically called out foreigners or non-Muslims and especially focused their violence on them. But there have also been lots of attacks, hacking attacks against Bangladeshis over time. How much of this is ISIS and how much of this is internal Bangladeshi tensions?
There have been about 40 attacks, and most of those targeted assassinations preceding the Dhaka hostage situation. These attacks were conducted by IS cells, and what we have seen is that they also used the IS methodology. So IS co-opted the existing group called Jamiatul Mujahid in Bangladesh, trained them and retrained them, and now the IS official news agency AMAK is claiming responsibility for those attacks. But certainly, the local group called Jamiatul Mujahideen Bangladesh, they have been deeply influenced by IS, and they do not identify themselves any longer as JMB, but as the Islamic State.
What is the appeal? The attackers in that case were described by survivors as clean-cut, seeming well-educated, sort of sophisticated young men. Now, ultimately, the police and army came in, and what, most or all of them died as well, I guess. But what's the appeal to a well-educated, well-positioned Bangladeshi to join this kind of slaughter, to perpetrate it?
Unlike Al-Qaeda, in the eyes of radicalized Muslim youth, they believe that IS has achieved so much. They control territory, they have declared a caliphate, and they have spoken of an end of times narrative where the great battle will be fought against Satan. And also, they believe that Sharia law or Islamic law will be imposed in the territories that they control. So there's a tremendous feeling for IS compared to Al-Qaeda, and they're willing to die because they believe, especially during the Ramadan period, if you engage in these attacks, that God will reward you more than attack being carried out during another phase. So we have seen that those youth who were attracted in Bangladesh, they all came from middle-class families, except one individual. And they all came from good schools, except one individual who came from a madrasa. And we have also seen that they spoke good English, and they had they attacked the upmarket diplomatic enclave area. And they were very familiar and comfortable of operating that area. That means IS is recruiting now from a cross-section of society, from the rich, from the poor, from the educated and the less educated. That means extremism, the ideology is spreading from the periphery of the Muslim community into the center.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about ISIS going global with its terror attacks in a pretty disconcerting way. What it means, what's the best response? Rohan Gunaratna joins us from Singapore. He's head of the International Center for Political Violence and Terrorism Research there at the Nanyang Tech University in Singapore. Paul Pillar joins us in just a moment from Washington. You can join us as well this hour. Have you been watching these headlines and the death tolls? More than 200 in Baghdad and right on around. Do you buy the view that we are beating them, ISIS, at home, so they're hitting out abroad? Does this look like a weakening ISIS? What is ISIS trying to do here? What reaction do they want? Can these threats be put down, bottled up? How? Here was a textile worker in Bangladesh, Dhaka, where 22 were killed, including a couple of police officers. The six attackers ended up dying as well. But here's Nasima. She expresses her fears and frustration. This is a vigil held Sunday for victims of the Friday attack that killed those 22.
We don't want this. Please stop this. Stop this. Stop this from our society, from our country. I want to live in peace.
We don't want this, but they've got it, and they're not alone by any means. Before Ramadan, back in May, this was ISIS spokesman Abu Muhammad al-Adnani. He's urging ISIS supporters around the world to carry out killings abroad during the holy month. He said that no attack was too small, urged people to attack where they were. I don't hear too much of that, but to the soldiers of the Islamic State and its supporters in Europe and Africa, he said, if the tyrants have closed in your faces the door of migration, then open the door of jihad and make their act a source of pain for them. He went on to say, you know, do it right where you are. The smallest action where you are is dearer to us than the largest action by us and more effective and more damaging to them. Rohan Gunaratna, please stand by in Singapore. With us as well right now from Washington is Paul Pillar, professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies Program, former National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. Paul Pillar, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
The simple message we're getting from American authorities over the weekend is they're losing at home, so they're hitting out abroad. We're checking that. Does that look right to you?
Yes, it does. I know it sounds like trying to put a favorable gloss on unfavorable events, but what we have to bear in mind, Tom, is that the basic approach and strategy of ISIS was fundamentally different from that of al-Qaeda in the following respect. Mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda's strategy was to go after the far enemy, meaning us, as part of a very long-term process of sowing dissension and division, and somewhere far up in the future, there would be a caliphate established. Mm-hmm. ISIS took a much different approach, establishing their so-called caliphate here and now. And their emphasis had been to build and maintain and grow that caliphate. And as for the instructions that ISIS high command, if you will, were sending out to sympathizers in the West and elsewhere, it wasn't initially do attacks in your home. It was come to the caliphate.
Yeah, come here.
Right. And it was only afterwards, after they came under the pressure that they did in Iraq and Syria and lost the ground that you talked about mm-hmm, earlier, mm-hmm. That the instructions changed.
So we initially heard ISIS recruits widely described as kind of social misfits gathering in the caliphate territory in Iraq and Syria. Now you may have just heard Rohan Gunaratne in Singapore saying they're with their success there and their message, they're attracting more mainstream Muslims to the movement. And we saw in Dhaka them deliver a very, very bloody result right in the heart of a pretty posh part of town.
Well, this gets into the much larger topic of, what drives radical extremism. And it's long been discounted that we're not just talking about poor people. We're not just talking about people who are desperate in distant and dry places. That's a much bigger topic. But where ISIS figures into this is it has become, the brand name du jour mm-hmm. for especially, radical, violent-prone Sunni extremists worldwide. They have more or less, not entirely, but for the most part, displaced al-Qaeda as the brand name du jour. They are seen as having had more success. And that's how the events on the ground and the military events in Syria and Iraq do make a difference, to the extent that ISIS is no longer seen as all that successful, that it is not the wave of the future. That makes their brand somewhat less appealing. And that is, insofar as the events we've seen, and that's an important qualification, mm-hmm. insofar as they have been initiated from the high command in Raqqa, I think it's partly to show their followers and their would-be recruits in Bangladesh, in the United States, in Europe, and everywhere else, that despite their setbacks in Iraq and Syria, they are still strong and alive and kicking and capable of doing damage worldwide.
I want to look at what kind of capacity they have to do that. I mean, I'm reading a report here that estimates that there were maybe a generous estimate was 500 hardened al-Qaeda operatives, kind of at the height of al-Qaeda's time, and people estimating maybe 30,000 active ISIS fighters, better trained, more capable in arms making bombs. A lot of them, thousands, have Western passports. Rohan Gunaratne in Singapore, does ISIS have the capacity to fight, to hang on to territory in the caliphate that it claims in the Middle East, and to continue rolling out terror attacks around the world at the same time?
ISIS is transforming from a caliphate-building organization to an operation-based organization. We have seen in the last 1 year, they have created the external operations wing. We have also seen that ISIS global expansion of creating the wilayats or the provinces in Nigeria, in Algeria, in Libya, in Egypt, in Yemen, in Saudi Arabia.
Satellites of the caliphate, in effect. Satellites.
Satellites. Mm-hmm. They have also grown. And we have seen that there are a number of about 30 to 40 different threat groups that have pledged allegiance to ISIS. And these groups are carrying out attacks on behalf of ISIS. So I believe that ISIS has suffered very significantly in the Middle East as a result of the U.S., Russian, and the Arab coalition campaigns. Certainly, ISIS cannot be eliminated in the short term. In the ISIS heartland, it will persist, but it will be weakened. But ISIS in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East will remain as ideology and as operational organization. And it is so important today for the world to develop a global strategy to counter the IS operational structures and also the ideologies. I feel that the Muslim countries and their religious authorities must play an important role. If these organizations, the Muslim organizations, the Islamic bodies are not going to do that, certainly there will be more attacks, and these attacks will continue.
So many questions there. Paul Pillar, I think many people watch the arc of the life of Al-Qaeda, and it seemed to suggest that these things rise and they fall, and that maybe ISIS would follow the same path. You've got others right now. You hear Rohan there saying you need a kind of tightly coordinated campaign, including Muslim countries and perhaps the West and more, to go after ISIS. I mean, how do you look forward from this point now, Paul? Is there an Al-Qaeda kind of fizzle in the future of ISIS, or will it take active resistance beyond the heartland of ISIS to roll it up?
ISIS as an organization, I don't believe, is going to last. I mean, there are inherent contradictions, particularly in what happens on the ground in their mini-state, in their caliphate. I mean, we have reports after reports of individuals who were inspired by the ISIS message, and they went there and they saw the reality on the ground, and many of them have wanted to come back, saying, get me out of here. The brutality, to put it quite bluntly, abhors and turns off many people, including many of the very Muslims to which they are trying to appeal. So I don't think the future overall is bright for ISIS. We are going to be plagued for quite some time with violent extremism, including among Sunni Muslims, which is the constituency to which ISIS appeals. And that brand name of ISIS may be around for quite a while, as the name under which attacks are conducted in disparate places, even after the caliphate in Syria and Iraq is a thing of the past.
Here's the Prime Minister of Bangladesh. This is Sheikh Hasina calling for 2 days of mourning for the people killed in the ISIS attack in Dhaka, Bangladesh, on Friday. She talked at a memorial on Saturday, saying that radical Islamists have no place in her country. Prime Minister of Bangladesh, these terrorists have no religion. This is how I feel, she says. They are a type of Muslim who kill people during a time of prayer. They don't pray, they kill people. They destroy the peace of Bangladesh. We will not allow them to live in Bangladesh. But there they are. Let's go to some callers here. Alan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
The point that I would like to make is that we're not really looking at the reality that this is political Islam, and we need to separate political Islam from textual and religious Islam. Until we're able to do that, we will not be able to not only fight ISIS, but we'll win, because ISIS right now is the apex political predator in the Islamic community. And the thought, ISIS theology, is becoming mainstream through the internet, and it's not going to go away unless the internet goes away and people aren't able to disseminate this political Islam. And unless there's a political Islamic movement that goes on the internet and preaches a political Islam that is able to counter this ideology, it will lose. If it was a Nazi party, everybody would say, okay, well, let's close the Nazis, let's surveil them, let's do this. But we have this hands-off policy that we have to do due to the fact that we say it's a religion, but this is politics.
What's hands-off about our American policy, Alan? I mean, we've been in there bombing away.
Bombs. It's not bombs. It's ideas and politics. We don't send anybody to speak at mosques and have organized Muslims to go to mosques and speak on behalf of a different political ideology. You have imams in most of the mosques that are funded by Wahhabi Sunni that are talking this fiery brand of theological Islam that says gays, lesbians, and transgenders should be killed to help them out. And unless we're willing to challenge this political ideology as an apex political predator, then I think that everybody of transgenders and different types are going to have to go back in the closet because we're afraid to talk the truth about this.
Alan, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Paul Pillar, what about this this distinction that Alan wants to make between religious Islam and political Islam? I don't know if he would even break it down that way. I mean, Islam in its teachings can be rather political. It envisions a society, not just a heavenly afterlife.
Well, you're right. I would not break it down that way. I mean, you have political Islam of very peaceful sorts that wouldn't concern us at all because it doesn't bring up extremism or the kind of violence that concerns us. But I think, I mean, there is a kernel of wisdom here in mm-hmm. the question mm-hmm. in that countering the interpretations of Islam that of the very warped sort that we get from ISIS certainly is an important part of countering the terrorism. It is a part that those of us in the predominantly Judeo-Christian West are not going to be very good at. It's going to be something where voices inside the Muslim world are going to be much more important. And there are efforts, including Muslim voices inside the West in places like the UK and so on, that have made concerted efforts to counter that sort of message. But that's only a part of it. Then there's all the other strictly military political stuff that we talked about before.
They've certainly shown a lot of ambition, ISIS. Brad in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Brad, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say I think we're misrepresenting what ISIS is doing. I don't think ISIS is weakening. They've used the resources that they have locally within the Middle East. I think this is part of their strategic global plan. Guerrilla warfare isn't about holding land. It's about being able to expand. And ISIS is using this time now that they've had resources to expand globally, and now they're after global resources. And I think that's why they're reaching out and they're able to get so many people globally is because that's where they understand the next asset is, not home in the Middle East.
Brad, let us pick that up. I mean, Rohan, I don't know if I agree with Brad there in this respect, that they declare a caliphate. And a caliphate was all about holding territory, having territory. And he's quite right. Guerrilla fighters may not want that. But do you accept that the ISIS is sincere, that the building a physical region, land-based caliphate is its number one goal, or something else that could be more fluid, Rohan?
ISIS' original plan was in the Middle East, but ISIS' vision is to create a caliphate from Spain to across Africa, through the Middle East, into Central Asia, and into up to Xinjiang.
In China, okay.
Yes, where there's a Muslim community in yep. Western China. Mm-hmm. So, but these are visions. But in reality, in practice, it is a huge challenge for them. But certainly, IS global expansion is going to make life very difficult for many countries in Asia. Because 63% of the world Muslim population, they live in Asia. And it's also difficult for IS to recruit from the Asian Muslim community because they are not politicized to that extent. But right now, the IS plan is to focus, to try to preserve what they can in the Middle East, but global expansion. And I believe that to challenge IS, the Western nations, the Middle Eastern nations, they have to be joined by the Asian countries because Asia also has a lot of resources. Asia is on the rise. So I believe that this is a global challenge, and unless governments work together, unless Muslim leaders, Muslim elite, they work together, IS will spread and will become a global challenge. In the Middle East, it will become more difficult. It will become more hard because now governments are much better organized and they are willing to fight this war. They have seen the danger of IS. But now IS is slowly creeping in and influencing other parts of the world. And many of those countries are not ready to fight. Many of those countries are confused. For example, Bangladesh Prime Minister, Home Minister, Information Minister said, this is not IS, these are Bangladeshis. But they don't understand that those Bangladesh youth have embraced IS.
I want to come back and talk about capacity to resist the Islamic State and coordination, how that might work in this arena. Of course, this on a day when President Obama is announcing that American troop withdrawal from Afghanistan will not go as rapidly as he had hoped only a short time ago. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. With Rocket Mortgage, you can get approved for a mortgage in minutes using a phone or tablet. This completely online process uses cutting-edge technology to make getting a mortgage more convenient than ever before. Now you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button without the frustration of digging through stacks of financial documents. Info at quickenloans.com/onpoint, equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about ISIS going global with its terror attacks in a pretty disconcerting way. What it means, what's the best response? Rohan Gunaratne is with us from Singapore, watching this from that vantage, seeing ISIS tentacles influence move more deeply into Islamic Asia in recent time. He's at the Center for Political Violence and Terrorism Research at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. Paul Piller is with us from Georgetown University's Security Studies Program. You can join us. How does this get fixed? How does it get stopped? We keep hearing leaders not far from ISIS saying this is not Muslim. That's not what this is. Last Wednesday, a speech in Ankara, Turkey, the president there, Erdogan, said the killing of dozens of civilians in that attack on the Istanbul airport last Tuesday, he said the terrorists showed they were not true Muslims, interpreted by CNN.
There's no Islamic explanation or aspect to this, not at all. And these people, what Muslims? These are going to be the occupants of hell. They have prepared, they have secured their places in hell.
The Turkish president, they have secured their places in hell. And yet we saw many more attacks after that. Rohan, Paul, please stand by. Valerie is calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Thank you for calling out. Valerie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm on the highway. I hope I don't lose reception.
Okay.
I just saw a TED talk, and I'm driving. I don't remember the woman's name, but
yep.
She did a talk on nonviolent protesting. One of the things she said that I thought was very powerful was that what somebody like the IS wants is attention. They are attention-seeking. Every time they do something nasty, they get attention. And it's all over. We know everything they do every time they bomb. Shut them down. Don't give them any attention at all. They're like children that are begging for attention. And I agree with her.
So don't pay attention. Don't, when the attacks come, you mean literally don't share the news of the attacks? So what do you exactly recommend?
Well, what she said is that we are constantly putting them out front, and that's exactly what they want.
Valerie, let us pick it up right there. Paul, what about it? Would we be better off? I mean, you know the nature of the news media. It's not likely that it's not going to report a lot on terror attacks. Is that a gift to ISIS? I mean, here we are sitting talking about ISIS, but what else are we supposed to do? It's a problem we want to address.
Well, this is an old, old problem with regard to how we handle terrorism, hardly unique to ISIS. Yes, there is a problem with overreaction and trying to make too much of things, or not trying to, but we do make too much of things, and that does in some ways serve the terrorist purposes. But Tom, you're right. You know, the press would not be doing its job if it turned a blind eye to things like the attacks at the Istanbul airport. And the reason a target like a major international airport, and that particular one I think is something like the sixth busiest airport in the world, is precisely to make sure it gets plenty of attention. And it's simply impossible not to report that. I think the excess attention and where we can try to cut things down is not the initial reporting, but everything else that could come under the heading of preoccupation. But here again, if you're, say, an American political leader, you can do your best to try to tamp down the fear and the concern, but you've got a public to deal with. You have political demands. People, mild or sore from what you reported from the streets of Baghdad, mm-hmm. that Prime Minister Abadi is dealing with.
Yeah, people throwing stones and shoes at his convoy.
Exactly. And so, you know, no American political leader is going to be able to say, well, folks, don't worry that much about terrorism because we don't want to draw attention to it.
What about Rohan Gunaratne saying the way to respond here is to coordinate, to use the capacity west, east, mid-east, and coordinate and go after ISIS in a very sort of a symphony of resistance. Is that the way? Is that happening, Paul?
A lot of it's happening. And indeed, based on my governmental experience, and I worked on counterterrorism for most of the 1990s as a mm-hmm. government official mm-hmm. in the intelligence community, counterterrorism is one where there is a lot more behind the scenes, behind closed doors, international cooperation going on every day, even with governments that we would normally consider not friends, but even adversaries. And part of that is that there is a lot of shared interest. You know, on the ISIS problem, we share interest here with the Russians, with the Iranians, others that are often regarded as adversaries and not just traditional friends and allies. And I have no doubt that a lot of cooperation is going on behind the scenes today, just as I was familiar with it 20 years ago.
Rohan Gunaratne in Singapore, what's more important here than continuing to reduce the ISIS footprint in the so-called caliphate in the Middle East or going after ISIS operatives or sympathizers globally?
We have to do both, but it is essential to dismantle the ISIS infrastructure in the heartland, because that is where ISIS originated. So it is imperative to contain, isolate, and eliminate the leadership of IS. It is also important, in parallel, there to be a global strategy to assist countries that should be engaged in order to dismantle ISIS in the provinces or in the wilayats, what you call the satellites in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, there must be a strategy where the Muslim countries should work using the universities, the schools, the media, the religious institutions to counter the extremist message of ISIS, because ISIS wants to create a rift between the Muslims and the non-Muslims. ISIS wants to create prejudice, suspicion, anger, hatred, incitement between communities. So we have to work with the religious and the educational and the media institutions to fight this.
Here's a listener writes online, a listener, Para, says, what can we do to counter the domino effect of Muslims becoming radicalized? She writes, clearly only monitoring people's phones and computers is not working, Rohan.
There must be, in parallel with countering the extremist ideology, in parallel there must be a program to promote moderation, toleration, and coexistence. Because the Al-Qaeda and the ISIS message is to introduce various concepts to create discord and dispute between the Muslims and the non-Muslims. And this promoting moderation should be done in real space, in the physical space that we all live, but also must be done in the cyber or the virtual space, because the cyberspace has become a key playing field for IS, Al-Qaeda, and their associated groups. The world has not yet woken up to this challenge, because the social media emerged only in late 2004. And since then, IS has exploited and harnessed social media to an extent we have never seen before. The governments and private companies and community organizations are just waking up to this challenge. IS, Al-Qaeda has moved very fast in this arena, and governments and religious organizations, religious authorities are trying to catch up.
Rishabh in Lexington, Massachusetts. Rishabh, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. My comment is based on a news report I was listening to on NPR yesterday, where they mentioned the attack on the holy sites near Saudi Arabia. And then along with that, there was this story that a lot of highest Muslim clerics condemned that attack in the most fierce term and all that. And that really kind of struck a nerve with me, because there were several other attacks, and I believe we're all sad about all attacks. So I was wondering why the Muslim clerics are not condemning every attack in the same way and not giving religious legitimacy to the people. So every attack should be the only way. I think this can be solved in some ways to make it religiously legitimate and I was really saddened to hear that only that attack got the, you know, the condemnation.
Yeah, just when it came to the holy sites. What about that, Paul? We've heard that for a while now. Of course, in this hour, we've heard from all kinds of heads of state saying it's not Muslim to attack in my country. I mean, is Saudi Arabia, are the Wahhabi sort of extreme Sunni sects there, are the Saudis in general now being bitten by something that they bred? And is there unified condemnation of ISIS among the most prominent Muslim leaders?
Well, I think if we keep a scorecard of what prominent Muslim leaders are saying, we can certainly find deficiencies, and not only in Saudi Arabia. But with regard to Saudi Arabia in particular, yes, they are being bit by something that was indirectly fed by ideology that's very close to what underpins the very legitimacy and history of the Saudi regime. The big event for them, or the turning point, came back around 2003 when there were al-Qaeda attacks for the first time of a serious sort in Riyadh and in the kingdom. And really, it was at that point that Saudi authorities turned away from what had been, to put it quite bluntly, tacitly a policy of exporting the problem, the radical problem, rather than dealing with it seriously. And it was only after targets inside the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia started being hit that Saudi counterterrorist policy, including the aspect that the questioner raises, that is to say, what influence the regime can have over the clerical establishment and what they say. It was only then that they got more serious about it. One can certainly continue to criticize along the lines that the statements from clerical leaders in Saudi Arabia ought to be even stronger.
We're going to turn to look at the big report that's just come out in the UK today on Britain's entry into the Iraq War. I want to thank the two of you both for being with us today. Paul Pillar at Georgetown University's Security Studies Program. Thank you very much, Paul.
My pleasure.
And Rohan Gunaratne in Singapore, thank you so much for sharing your insights on ISIS today, Rohan. Thanks for joining us there.
Thank you.
With us right now from London is Steve Erlanger, London Bureau Chief for the New York Times. In the UK today, the Chilcot Report has come out looking at Britain's entry into the Iraq War. Steve Erlanger, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
What is the toughest criticism of Tony Blair and the UK government of the time in this report?
Well, the toughest criticism is that they mismanaged the process, that they didn't check their own assumptions, that they went along too easily with Washington, and that Mr. Blair in particular overestimated the solidity of the intelligence he was given and underestimated how little influence he would have over President George W. Bush.
What's the consequence of this report likely to be? After all these years, 7 years, I think I heard, in the making, are Britain still hanging on this in terms of forward-going policy? Is it to do mainly with Tony Blair's backward-looking reputation? What consequence do you see, Steve?
Well, it's a very good question, because at this point, you know, one can say, what are the real revelations? I think it's important for a country that was so scarred by that war, so scarred that it was reluctant to get involved in Syria and reluctant to join President Obama on chemical weapons and reluctant for a long time to spend 2% of its budget, of its GDP, on defense. There was the sense that Britain had been dragged in foolishly to an unjustified war on the American side against its real allies and on the basis of fake intelligence. And so it was very important to clear the air. A lot of classified stuff came out, particularly from the British side. I don't think it changes our understanding of what happened, but it does. It's a fascinating look at the processes of government and how concerns about the Americans' lack of planning and Britain's own lack of planning and the lack of political support among the French and Germans, all somehow prescient concerns got swept aside in the rush to war. And in Blair's decision to go along with President Bush in the hope, I think, of constraining and guiding him. In the end, I think Blair was taken for a ride, and it's been very painful here. Blair is widely detested despite having won three election victories.
Yeah.
And nowhere more so than in his own exploded Labour Party, which is now being led by a man who essentially was always against the war and is a kind of a non-nuclear pacifist.
Fallout for a long time from a major war based on untruths from the start. What about direct or indirect criticism of the United States here, assessment of U.S. competence that comes through in this report, Steve?
Well, there's a lot of criticism, to be sure. There were a lot of worries expressed by, you know, Blair's top aides and his officials. But there was this kind of, you know, Blair, who was very supportive and pushing the Kosovo War, for instance. And, you know, he really mm-hmm. was a believer in humanitarian intervention. He was a believer in the world order after the fall of communism. He had a very good relationship with Clinton and hoped to have the same with Bush. And, you know, these aspirations now can seem utopian. But he was always kind of balancing his desire to be in the thick of creating a new order of peace and stability, his anger at dictatorship and tyranny, and his desire to be a real player alongside the United States. And that, I think, blinded him to the consequences. He himself, early on, you know, 8 months before the war started, tried to press on President Bush, which comes out in this report, that this could have unintended consequences and a lot of civilians could die and that it all had to be managed very, very well and there needed to be a political coalition and UN Security Council approval. And all that somehow faded away as the drums of war proceeded. And it was quite clear that, you know, President Bush was going to go to war, and he was going to go to war by, you know, mid-March of 2003.
A decision years and years ago, fallout of which we're still living very much with today. Steve Erlanger with the New York Times, London Bureau Chief, as the big report comes out in the UK today. You can read the whole thing at our website, onpointradio.org. Steve Erlanger, thank you very much for joining us for a few minutes today.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.